This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. DNA testing was once the provenance of forensic scientists or specialized medical offices. But the technology needed to gather DNA samples and the cost of doing it have changed dramatically in recent years. One example, the company 23andMe. They advertise their DNA test kits on TV for just under $100.
I always wondered what my DNA said about me.
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 Now, I know.
Know more about your health. Go to 23andMe.com and order your DNA kit for only $99 today. Learn hundreds of things about your health.
But those hundreds of things about your health should be approached very carefully. How likely are you to develop Alzheimer's or certain cancers? Could risks be passed to your kids? Now, deciding whether or not you want to know these things and then determining what to do once you do know is a lot trickier than slapping down $100 and sending away a spit sample. Today on the program, we're going to look at the ethical and practical questions of DNA testing with John Burke, professor of microbiology and molecular genetics at the University of Vermont. Professor Burke, nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Jane.
And of course, one of the reasons that we asked you here, and you in fact suggested that we ask you here, is because you have done this. You have gotten your DNA tested.
Right. I have sent off my spit and my $99 and got the results back about 3 weeks later.
And what did you find? Anything interesting?
There's a lot that's interesting. They give you sort of a division of your results into one half that's all about your health and the other half that tells you things about your ancestry. And it told me I potentially have a couple of health conditions that I might not have known about. I have a low risk of some things, a higher risk of some other things. And it tells me that my ancestry is just as boring and uniformly European as my parents and my grandparents told me it was.
It also, though, told you you might have been a sprinter or should have been a sprinter.
Yes, it says that when, you know, you look through these results and say, how do I know they didn't get my sample mixed up with somebody else? And it said, you know, I don't have hair loss, which is right. I have blue eyes and blonde hair, which is right. But it also said I had the muscle type that a lot of sprinters have, and I feel very confident that I am not now and never have been a sprinter.
Well, maybe you just missed a chance in high school.
I did. Could be.
Why did you want to get your DNA tested?
Mostly for educational purposes. So at UVM, I teach a course called Genetics and Genomics and also teach some genetics to the medical students. And I have been keeping an eye on these direct-to-consumer tests for some time. You know, I follow the results in the literature for the scientific studies and have been aware that people have been starting as consumers to go out and collect their own information. And when the price dropped to less than $100, I said, holy smokes, my students are going to start having this done. I better have mine done, too, so that I know, you know, what the issues are. What do they tell you? What they don't tell you? How clearly do they link the results back to the literature? Do they update things when new results come out? And is there anything in these reports that we should worry about?
And are your students actually doing this already?
Yeah. So two of my students had already had the analysis done before the class started. And several more since we have kind of a project-oriented approach. And last week I gave them access to all of my data. And this week they're telling me about it. So probably more of them will choose to have it done.
So they're analyzing your DNA in
yes.
your class.
Yes.
Why? Why is that helpful?
So they will know what's wrong with me, I suppose, and maybe be able to know.
Right. Aren't you just getting a lot of, you know, second opinions now?
I am. So what they've done is they've each chosen one particular trait or characteristic or inherited condition or something having to do with my ancestry, and they're writing up an article about that and looking into the research that supports that and what exactly do my results say and what does that mean about my risk for whatever they're looking at.
Is that somehow more helpful than just doing a theoretical approach? I mean,
I think it is because it gives the students what I'm thinking about is asking the students as part of the course to do an analysis on either their genome or if they're not comfortable with doing theirs, then somebody else's genome. The idea, I think, is if you're looking at your own DNA, you have a certain increased interest, curiosity, and maybe motivation to go a little bit more into the details. So I think it'd be a good learning experience.
We are talking today about DNA testing, which you can now do for under $100, making it more accessible to more people who might be curious about what their DNA tells them about themselves. We're going to look at how it actually works, as well as what the implications might be. I mean, how could this information be used, and are we ready to know what these results are going to tell us? Listeners, if you have questions or experience or thoughts on the ethical issues we're talking about here, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. We got a note from Meg who says, "My son gave his sister a DNA kit for her birthday. It was an especially thoughtful gift because she is adopted. He wanted her to have access to her genetic health history. Both of her brothers are our biological children. He felt they had the availability of our family health history through oral recount and firsthand experience. She didn't have access to this information. She loved her gift and was touched by his thoughtfulness."
That's a wonderful gift. My wife, who's a family physician, and I were talking about this the other day, and who would it be really useful for? And Karen's first thought was exactly what this writer talks about, which is people who are adopted or don't, for whatever reason, have good communications with their parents or other relatives. It's a good way to kind of get an overview of what sorts of things might run in your family. And the best thing you can do with that information, whether it's actually very similar information, that if you can get accurate information from your parents and your grandparents or from the DNA analysis, what it tells you and maybe tells your doctor are things that you have to keep an eye out for. You know, mine says that I have a very high risk of macular degeneration and that we won't do anything differently, but it'll just give me further motivation to go in and get my eyes checked annually to see if something like that is developing.
Professor Work, what else does this actually tell you? I mean, if you're getting this test, what are you actually finding out?
So technically what they're doing is reading your genome at about 3 million specific points. And if you download all of the raw data, which being kind of geeky I did, you get a very long list of these sites on your chromosome, and this is what letter or letters you have there, G, A, T, or C. The interpreted view, and I think 23andMe does a really good job of showing this to you at sort of a high level and then letting you drill down for more details if you're interested in doing so. What you get is a list on the health side of, you get a health overview and then separate list of carrier status for different diseases, different traits you might have, your likely response to certain drugs and things like that. And they'll separate them into decreased risk, increased risk, and so forth. So you get about 250 different potential conditions and a genetic sense as to whether your risk for that condition is higher, lower, or average.
And are you, I mean, let's say you were a person with no family history of any diseases. Are you then likely to be average in everything? Or, I mean, aren't you sort of going to be increased or decreased in just about
everything?
Yeah, so
that's one of, when you have your DNA analyzed, you have to go in with the mindset that, you know, no matter what your mom and your fifth grade teacher told you, you are not perfect. And everybody's got little genetic quirks in different places around their chromosomes. And because of genetic variation in the population, we all have something wrong with them. I mean, we all have several mutations that if they were homogeneous in our DNA might be lethal and we might not be here. But we've got two copies of all of our DNA, and in most cases when there's a bad copy, there's also a good copy present.
Well, so let's take you for an example. Mm-hmm. Since you're opening up your whole genome to us, it looks like you have a higher risk of getting melanoma, skin cancer. And it's double the risk, right, of what a normal
person?
Right, it's
4% instead of 2%.
Right, so talk a little bit about that, because
yes,
you could get really hung up on the idea that your risk of developing melanoma is twice the risk of average.
There's a couple of ways to look at that. One is that, you know, you might say that nobody should look at this stuff unless they have a good understanding of relative risk. and what it actually means. The other way to look at it is that if you don't have an understanding, after you've looked at it and talked about it, you probably will have a good sense of risk and what it is. So what it says is my melanoma risk is 4% instead of 2%. So yes, it's twice as high as the typical person, but it's only 4%. Where if you look at some of the other things like obesity, you know, my risk is lower than normal, but it's still 40% or something. So you have to understand sort of absolute risk, and then the DNA tells you how much you vary, you know, increased or decreased rather to the typical risk. Because DNA, it's all about probabilities. Your DNA doesn't determine everything about your life. It just gives you sort of a baseline to start with. And the health decisions you make and dietary decisions and so forth and environmental decisions may, in most cases, have a bigger effect than your DNA does on your health.
But then something like macular degeneration, yep. You mentioned that that was something that is fairly significant for you to learn about.
Yes, in that I have about a 50% chance of developing it. But on the other hand, it's nothing that you can go in and intervene and do something about. It's just something that you either get or you don't.
And this is an eye problem that often affects older people.
Yeah. So what I told my class is if they see me driving around in 30 years, they should call the police and get me off the road.
Today I'm talking with UVM Professor of Molecular Genetics and Microbiology, John Burke. He's helping us tease apart what it means that our individual DNA analysis is at our fingertips now. For $100, you can find out what your propensity for breast cancer might be, or whether or not you're actually your father's child. But those are pretty heavy things to learn about, and if you're unprepared for the results of your DNA testing, you might be thrown for quite a loop. Let us know what questions you have about the practical and ethical implications of DNA testing. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Professor Burke, this idea of figuring out your paternity, for example, I mean, you're not taking your father's DNA and yours and comparing them, but you might find out things about your ancestry that don't jive with what your family has
exactly.
told you.
So if you're the only one that's having your DNA analyzed, you would probably do what I mentioned earlier, which is you just flip through the results and say, do these make sense based on what I know or do I not? And I think the statistics are that for people who have suspicions that one of their parents might not really be their biological parent, they're right about half the time. And even for people who have no suspicions, it turns out they're one or both of their parents may not be who they think they are biologically. But you won't normally find that out until you start comparing your analysis to that of a sibling or to that of your parents or grandparents or something. So if you're asking questions along those lines, like, you know, are you really my dad? you probably ought to think long and hard about whether or not to get this done. Also, when you do have the analysis done, you have a choice as to which results you want to see or not. And so you could not have your maternal and paternal report sent to you.
So you could decide exactly what parts of the analysis you actually want to see.
Sure. So there are some things that people are very sensitive about. One of them is their status for genes associated with Alzheimer's diseases. And some people, so that they'll, when you log in, when they have your results ready, they say, do you want to see your health results, yes or no? And then, do you want to see your Alzheimer's results? And if you check yes, they'll say, you know, here are some reasons why some people have chosen not to see them. Are you really sure? Because once you see this information, you've seen it, and it's in your head, and you can't get rid of it.
So there are sort of a lot of turnaround points that
There are turnaround points with your ancestry and as well.
What about something like breast cancer? You know, mm-hmm. that's been in the news a lot about people who in some cases want to get genetic testing, often have done it through doctor's offices,
right.
specialized genetic screening to find out if they're at a higher risk for breast cancer.
Yeah, and that's an important distinction to make because the $99 23andMe is a broad screen of your whole genome. It's not an authoritative analysis of any particular risk or condition. So although the information that comes back will say something about your risk for breast cancer or prostate cancer or whatever, it won't give you the whole story that you would get if you went into for genetic counseling through your obstetrician or something and wanted to know, or if your family doctor and wanted to know what the deal is for you. And often the reason that people will have the more detailed tests is because they know there's a family history and they want to know if how much that really applies to them.
So how could you use these tests then when you do go to your doctor and mm-hmm. say, you know, here's what I found out. What do I do with it?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And, you know, I brought in a summary of my results, which is about 50 pages of paper here. And that's only a small fraction. And I thought, what would my primary care doctor do if I showed up for an appointment with this ream of paper or had emailed her access to my account and expected her to have gone through all of that information? And I don't think it's actually all that useful. I don't think it's any more use. I think it's about as useful to a primary care doctor as a good family history is. So in the case of the adopted person, it might say that there was a reason to think about worrying about breast cancer or colon cancer or what have you. But the information would be appropriately used by a doctor, I think, just like family history, in that it would give your doctor clues about what to watch out for. Maybe, you know, keep a careful eye about, maybe do screening for this particular condition every 2 years instead of every 5 years or something like that. But it's nothing. I think very few people are going to get a result in here that really makes them say, oh, my God, I'm going to die next week of, you know, condition X.
Let's go to John calling in from Richmond. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question. Can you get the genetic testing done on an anonymous basis in case something shows up you don't want the insurance companies to know about?
Yeah, so I spent a little time going through their terms of service this morning to answer that very question. And what they do say is that they keep your information private and it's only released to you or to people that you have specifically given permission to see your information. So if that's all correct and they have good security policies and practices in place, then really nobody should see it except for you. I guess there was a phrase in there about sometimes they might be legally compelled to release your information. And I was trying to figure out exactly what circumstance that might be and didn't really come up with anything. So it's thought to be, it's supposed to be very private.
What about, though, the idea that insurance companies could use this at some point? I understand the law says insurance companies aren't allowed to use genetic testing
the
results.
The law says that they're not allowed to use genetic testing results for health insurance. But as I understand it, that doesn't apply to life insurance or to disability insurance. And I don't think those laws have been particularly well tested in the legal system yet. So there could be some concern for that. And that's why I'm 59 years old and I sort of know what health conditions I've got and I'll be on Medicare before you know it. And so I feel comfortable in not worrying about that too much. But if I was 20 years old, that might be a reason why I might choose not to have the analysis done.
Just because the laws haven't caught up yet with the technology.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's go to Paul in Port Henry. Hey, Paul, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I've had several tests done with family tree DNA, a Y DNA, and a mitochondrial test. And then recently with Ancestry.com has a new one, which I don't quite understand. It's more general. It just compares similar people and finds cousins and that sort of thing. It comes up with thousands of possible connections, some of which have, when you go to the family trees they post, prove correct. I was also pleased that it showed that my mother was my mother, which I was confident of because I had her tested too.
Did you thank your mom for that?
I did. We had a good chuckle about it. But it has, that one in particular has connected with people that kind of verifying the historical records we have.
Paul, thanks for your call. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you can use this to trace not just your health questions, but your ancestry and your genealogy and get some answers about that. We got another question from Angelica, who wants to know about DNA tests and genealogy of maternal lines. She says, I'm under the impression that DNA tests are less useful for information about maternal lines, particularly lines such as a mother's father's mother. Is that true? Can you talk about this a little?
I'm going to have to map this out.
No, mother's father's mother.
Yes. So there are two particular lineages of DNA that people have that can be traced to either their mother or their father. All of us have the mitochondrial DNA, which is transmitted through the maternal line. So my mitochondrial DNA came from my mother, and hers came from her mother, and hers came from her mother, and so forth. And then if you have a Y chromosome, if you're male, your Y chromosome came down to you through your father. So my Y chromosome came from my father, and his came from his father. So there are specific bits of your lineage that can be analyzed and are reported as your maternal lineage or your paternal lineage. And then there's the bulk of your DNA, which comes from sort of random assortment of DNA from all of your biological ancestors.
So there are limitations to what you're going to be able to find about your genealogy.
Oh, for sure. But I think as more work gets done, more specific information will be available. So in the 23andMe analysis, they pooled resources with Ancestry.com, and the Ancestry analysis that you get as part of the 23andMe analysis is the same that you get through the Ancestry. And it does tell you, you know, it tells me it's identified 266 fourth cousins of mine and 721 more distant cousins of mine. And some people might want to look them up, but I have enough trouble dealing with the relatives that I know about without chasing down a whole bunch of new ones.
Are these other people who have already gone through the testing?
Yes, they're in the same database, and it's made connections between us.
Are there other companies doing this kind of work? I mean, you're mentioning one specific one that you used, but...
Yeah, and this is an interesting issue. About 3 or 4 years ago, I think there were half a dozen companies that were offering this service, including 23andMe, and the price of these services was something like $5,000 to $10,000 each, so they had a pretty limited market. So one of the things that 23andMe has done is to make the analysis as automated and inexpensive as it can be, and so they've really undercut in price all of these others who have either merged with them, gone off to do more clinical or forensic analysis, or just gone out of business. So there aren't many other companies out there that are doing this. There are a lot that will do clinical testing. There are a lot that will do forensic analysis. But in terms of direct-to-consumer, 23andMe is getting essentially all of the business at this point.
We got a note from Frederick who says, I had a genome test done to determine whether or not someone was related to me, as he claimed. This was verified, and we now have a new branch on the family tree. I learned also how much Neanderthal DNA I have, along with finding dozens of third and fourth cousins, just like Professor Burke mentioned. Let's go to Jerry, calling in from Burlington. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Fascinating topic. I haven't heard it brought up for some time. But I do remember when the human genome mapping capability became available, one of the questions that was asked that I thought was fascinating was whether or not culturally we were prepared to deal with the results that we might have revealed to us in such a process. And your guest has alluded to a couple of them. I'm 70 years old. I'm diabetic. I have macular degeneration and so on. You know, am I going to go blind? And I don't know whether the test is sufficiently sophisticated that it will give you that information. But for the moment, I'm like him. I'm just sort of monitoring it and proceeding on.
Jerry, would you do something more? Would you get a genetic test? I mean, are you interested in that?
Well, it fascinates me. And yet at the same time, I think part of what gives life its value is its mystery. And answering too many questions is not necessarily, at least in my view, a particularly good idea. The best example of that I can give, by way of metaphor, is everybody today seems to know what the sex of their baby is going to be. And I remember 35 years ago, that was one of the great revelations that occurred at birth, you know, and now we want all those answers in advance. And I'm not sure that at least for some of us, maybe myself included, we are emotionally or psychologically prepared to deal with having all of those questions presented to us.
Yeah, Jerry, thanks for bringing up that point. Interesting one. I want to read an email and then we'll get Professor Burke's reaction, because Michelle was talking about what Jerry was just talking about there at the end, this idea of what you can find out before your baby is even born. She says researchers have recently developed a new process called cell-free DNA testing for expectant parents. With a simple blood draw from the mother, it's now possible to construct the developing baby's DNA. Right now, this new test just checks for three major trisomies and the baby's gender. But researchers have said that the possibility exists to check for just about anything, whether or not our babies will be prone to diabetes, obesity, heart disease, etc. It brings up an interesting and related question. How much do we want to know about our unborn babies? And how can we make ethical decisions, like whether or not to carry or terminate based on that information? So Jerry and Michelle here talking about, whoa, where is it going, this information that we're suddenly going to be getting?
That's a really good point, and it's a really important thing for people to think about. I think with all decisions having to do with medical testing or DNA analysis, you have to ask yourself, what information am I going to get back, and what am I going to do with that information? If I get answer X, what would I do? And if you're not prepared to deal with that, or if you just like to be surprised, which is a perfectly reasonable way to go about doing things, I think, then maybe you shouldn't get it done, or you shouldn't ask to see those parts of the results when they come back.
But where do you think this is going? Do you foresee a time when maybe it's prenatal testing, or maybe it's at a baby's first, you know, routine physical after birth, you get this genetic test and then it helps the parents decide how to raise the kid?
Yeah, I think we're quite possibly heading in that direction. And that's one of the reasons why I'd like to start incorporating some of this into the education of our medical students at UVM. A full DNA analysis like this on every baby at their first year checkup would probably just cause a lot of parents who already worry about their kids a lot to continue to worry, but really wouldn't do anything materially to improve the health of the kids. In the 23andMe website, they have different forums, essentially blogs, for people to discuss their results and try to understand them. And it's quite clear that a lot of people get the results and kind of freak out. They say, oh, my God, I never thought I had a risk for disease X, which I didn't even know about until I saw this result. And you have to keep in mind, again, that it's all just based on probabilities and tendencies. And the DNA is not telling you what your destiny is. It's just telling you what things you may have a higher or lower risk for compared to the rest of the population. And you have to really understand that.
So it's powerful information. You've got to figure out how you are going to deal with it, again,
right,
as you said, before you get it.
Right. If you have sort of an obsessive personality and you know you're not going to be able to sleep because you're worried about this, it's clear that the stress would do more harm to your health than anything good you can do with the test results.
Let's go to Julie in Burlington. Hey, Julie.
Hi there. You know, I appreciate your comments, and I just want to say one thing. I was, I have a chronic illness that my parents, if they had done this sort of testing, probably would have discovered or had known that I was, you know, had a tendency to. And I have to say, even though, you know, the illness and everything I've had to go through is terrible, it has, without a doubt, added an enormous value to my life and a part of the journey that I can't think of my life without it and what it would be like, and I certainly wouldn't be on the path I am now. So I understand not wanting to put children through horrible illnesses and devastating, you know, treatments and whatnot, but I have to say there is something to it in terms of shaping character and journey, and I don't think that that should be left out of the debate.
Julie, would you get your DNA tested now to find out what else you're susceptible to?
No, I don't think I would. Actually, my partner and I have talked about this, and we've talked about this in light of the possibility of having children. And I think that too much knowledge is too much power. And just like the previous caller commented on, you know, not having the joy of finding out a baby's sex when they're born, I don't think I would.
Well, thank you very much for calling in. Appreciate your perspective. John Burke, what do you think there about what Julie's saying?
I think that makes good sense. I think the group of people that probably should think the hardest about whether they want to have this done are people that are pregnant or are thinking of becoming pregnant, because when you get to that point, it's not just your health that you're talking about, and things get much more complicated. So individual choice.
Though it's a brave new world, we don't know where we're going with this in terms of what our doctors are going to recommend in the future, what insurance companies are going to require, and how the law is going to fit with what we are finding out. It's an interesting, interesting perspective. John Burke is a professor of microbiology and molecular genetics at the University of Vermont. Thanks very much for bringing this idea to our attention.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, singer-songwriter Eliza Moore. She's taken a circuitous route to the sound on her latest album, ethereal, poppy, with hints of Renaissance influences and even a whisper of punk. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We like to keep an ear out for talented musicians around our state and region, and I sat down recently with Eliza Moore, a Vermont-born singer-songwriter who now lives in Montreal. Some of her earliest childhood memories are of waking up to the sounds of her mother singing scales and her father playing the cello at their home in North Montpelier.
I had a very unique music-filled childhood. First of all, I grew up in an old tavern house, and it really lent itself to, I think, to music. Well, maybe that's just because my family was always filling its rooms with music. But yeah, my father played cello. My mother is a classical singer. And then my sister and I began playing violin at age 5 so we could fill out the family string trio. Yeah, my parents were always encouraging music in the community, and my mom was very much heading off the different performances at the Barry Opera House, and she would incorporate us, the children as well, sometimes in various productions at the Opera House. So, you know, I was sort of thrown in at an early age.
So why didn't you rebel and say, forget it, I'm not doing music when I go to college? Instead, you go and you study music.
I didn't necessarily decide I wanted to go into music. I think music was something I took for granted for a long time. It just was part of my lifestyle, and I would always play. And then in college, my major was in history, early European history, and then the music was sort of a minor. And then halfway through college, my father passed away, and I realized how important music was in my life, and I just snapped. And all of a sudden, it was like, no, music is the path. So that was pretty much the turning point. Yeah.
And yet you still talk about needing to find yourself and find your way in music and find right. What kind of music you wanted to do.
This is true, for sure. So after that time in life, I took some time out from school, and my friend Anya Burgess, who's now actually in a very successful Cajun band down in Louisiana, she and I traveled around Europe for about just under a year. Spent quite a bit of time in Ireland, where I found a real connection to the Irish music and, of course, the fiddle, and also just began writing my own songs. That was a big sort of sending into my own voice, so to speak. But then I went back to school and I began studying early music. There were a lot of people saying, oh, you should go pursue this. You really have an affinity for this kind of music. I went to Indiana University to get a master's after college. And as in any conservatory, there's a lot of criticism. There's a lot you come up against. And so in fact, I left and pursued a different degree in London, which was much more open and much more about composition and very much around world music and the multiculturalism that is in London. And the program itself was geared towards professional musicians who wanted to find a different way of expressing their music in the community, in the world. And we would go into schools and hospitals and create works of art, both music, dance, storytelling, these sorts of things with children and with other professional musicians. In fact, the London Philharmonic we worked with and the other professional groups in London.
Well, you describe your third album, your EP, mm-hmm. Everything to Me, as your voice, you know, mm-hmm. refinding who you are as a person and as a solo musician. So let's hear one of the songs. What do you want us to play?
Well, let's start with the title track. This is a song I wrote my son. So I have a 3-year-old son, and he was 1 month old when I wrote this song. It was my birthday, and I received a Ergo baby carrier. And so all of a sudden, I snapped him in, and all of a sudden I had hands, and I picked up the guitar and I looked down at him, and this is the song that came out more in a lullaby version. But then when I worked with producer Jay Nash in Vermont, he kind of picked it up a bit, made it a little more poppy, danceable. Son?
I do, but actually the best part is that he actually sings it back to me now. It is, you can't imagine. I wake up some mornings and he looks up and thinks, "You are everything to me in this world."
Oh.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's pretty amazing.
So the first thing that you do when you get a birthday present of a baby carrier for your son is sit down and write a song about your son. Is that the kind of place where you usually get inspiration? Is that kind of personal stuff going on in your life?
For sure, it's personal stuff. For me, it's definitely large events in life. It's births, it's marriage, it's deaths. It's those sort of soul-shifting moments in life. I'm not a big storyteller in a song. It's more impressionistic, more about the sentiment and the shifts and the searchings within. Yeah.
Well, let's hear another one off Everything
okay.
to Me.
Okay.
Do you want to play Shimmer?
Let's play Shimmer for sure. I love this tune, Shimmer. And I just recently created a music video for this song.
You don't really love to be a storyteller in your songs, but there's a pretty clear storyline in that one, or at least a sort of a narrative theme that you can picture what's going on.
That's a good point. That song does paint a picture, a real landscape. Maybe it is a little more of a story than most of my songs. Okay. But even so, it is, I guess if I were to sort of refine it down, it is how when we look out at nature, we feel enlightened by the beauty and vice versa. It also helps to see our inner beauty as well.
So we've heard these two very beautiful, very melodic songs. And before we let you go, mm-hmm. I want you to tell us then
yes.
how you managed to be in an electropunk band, Swedish Radar, and what that does for you.
Well, I really love to rock it out, shall we say? And that's like my other personality. Actually, one of the tracks on this record is from that band. I co-wrote it. The electropunk band, I guess, is a bit of an outlet for me. And it's, I use the fiddle and lots of effects and loops and then drum and bass. So it's, electric violin and drum bass. And then I sing as well.
Well, Eliza Moore, it sounds like you have a lot of experimenting going on. There's a great picture on your website where you're singing. You've got the fiddle in one hand, your guitar is strapped onto you, and you're sitting in front of a keyboard. So if that gives you some picture of all of the major influences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eliza is a singer-songwriter who grew up in North Montpelier, now lives in Montreal. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'm so glad we got to play a couple of cuts from Everything to Me, your new EP.
Thank you so much, Jane. I really appreciate it.
Eliza Moore may live in Montreal, but she plays in Vermont quite often, and you can find a link to her website on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net.
The iconic U.S. Route 66 stretches over 2,400 miles from Grant Park in Chicago to the Santa Monica Pier in California. Vermont Route 66 is a little shorter and has inspired far fewer songs and folklore. It's actually less than 10 miles long, running from East Randolph to Randolph. But there's still a lot to experience. VPR's Rick Sengary set out to get some kicks on Vermont Route 66. And today, in the first of a three-part series, he visits the farms in that corner of Orange County.
Boys! Boys! Come on, girls, let's go!
That's Chester Abbott calling in his cows at Wayside Farm. The farm sits perched high on a ridge on the aptly named Ridge Road. There, Abbott can look out over Randolph and Braintree as he sets to milk his herd of organic cows.
I'm going to sneak up alongside him, probably best if you just follow through.
Right.
You can talk to him and practice your herding.
Come on, girls. Come on.
Oh, you're natural.
Yeah, but now they're coming back after me.
We milk around 40 to 50 generally, depending on the time of year. Jerseys and Ashers, a little more on, it's getting more on the Jersey side.
I'm more inclined to the Jerseys.
How much interest do your sons have in the operation and taking over?
No, my oldest son, he complains about it, but I mean, somehow I think in the back of his mind he appreciates the fact that, this is his experience, and I think someday he will appreciate that. And I almost think he appreciates it now, even though he's only 14. But my youngest two decided they wanted to come to the barn with me yesterday morning. It's fun to have them. It's fun to have the company. And, and they, together, they're 6 and 8. I mean, they can go out and get the cows for me in the morning. And it's really cool to look out the window and see them out there in the dim light bringing the cows up while I'm getting set up. And it saves me 15 minutes, too. Of course, I spent that 15 minutes trying to get them out of bed. But I wouldn't have traded my youth, my experience for anything else. And I remember when I was a kid, driving just through, small suburban areas of Vermont and thinking, that's where they live and that's all they just have to play right there in their backyard. Of course, I didn't learn how to throw a baseball, so I'm still working on my mechanics.
A few miles away, right on Route 66 in Randolph Center, Vermont Technical College has its own dairy operation, run by Stephanie Nall.
I did not grow up on a dairy farm. My father drives tractor-trailer, and my mother delivers mail, and my sister's a hairdresser, and my brothers work in excavation and always have. In high school, I had a friend whose uncle had a farm in Vermont, and I just always liked animals as a kid, but my parents never really had the place for them. So I got a couple pairs of steers when I was in high school, and then just really fell in love with it, and I came here to visit my friend from high school who is a graduate of the program. The first day I came, I was in the milking parlor that evening with them, and it was awesome, and so I just decided it was what I really wanted to do.
And now that you're doing it, is it everything you thought it would be?
Yeah, I think it's actually more.
In what way?
I don't know, I just, every day learning something new, and I just have really taken to it. Saturday night, there was a cow calving. I left chores 7:30 at the barn, and she was calving, and I said, I gotta come down and check on her later. Came down at midnight, she had made no progress, and I said, I gotta pull this calf. I really wasn't looking forward to it since I had to be here at 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was backwards, so, it was a good thing I did come down. And when I looked at the calf on the ground, I said, man, this is why I do this.
Stephanie Nall says that VTC's dairy operation currently ships its milk to a commercial dairy processor, but in the near future hopes to be bottling its own milk to be used on campus. For VPR News, I'm Rick Sengary.
Tomorrow, we're going to visit some of the businesses that have grown up along State Route 66. Also on the show tomorrow, individual learning plans. Last session, the legislature mandated that all students in grades 7 through 12 develop personalized learning plans. The students at Mount Abraham High School in Bristol have been experimenting with personalized learning for a while now. We're going to get an in-depth look at the program at Mount Abe and find out how personalized learning might look when it's applied around the state. Send your comments or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.